No, you tell it.
No, you.
I'm not telling it.
You should totally tell it.
Well, you should tell it.
No, you tell it.
Hello, and welcome to Know You Tell It, a hybrid story incubator / performance series. Each Know You Tell It participant develops their true life tale on the page, and then switches with a partner to perform each other's work on stage. Because nothing informs your story like hearing someone else perform your story. Today's Two on Tuesday stories were recorded live on a particularly rockin' night at Jimmy's No. 43 in the East Village, as part of our In Transit show. In the story Song Lines, a singer-songwriter has an adventure in Ireland and finds all sorts of new doors opening for her. The remarkable Rebecca Hart will be appearing in the Civilians' Rambeau in New York at BAM in March, a development for which we can take absolutely no credit. Read for us by Molly Tauger, here is Song Lines, written by Rebecca Hart.
One, Song Lines. From Wikipedia. A song line, also called dreaming track by Indigenous Australians, is a path across the land, followed by creator beings during the dream time, i.e. creation. The paths of the song lines are recorded in traditional songs. The songs must be continually sung to keep the land alive. From a random website I found, song lines are about singing where you've been or creating a map with words. The literal concept of song lines is to sing the trail, to sing the place, to recreate and remember the physical landscape in song. And it should be noted, this doesn't just apply to a literal landscape. And finally, those who ancient lines did lay will heed the song that calls them back. Jethro Tull. Two, a song's lines. Kyrie. Sanctify, nevermore be. You have heard the tale 100 times before me. When the nighttime comes and the salt wind blows, then the mothership comes sailing on the white sea foam. Do not hide your heart. Do not break your hold. When the mothership may call you, you will surely go. These are the lyrics to a song. It is a song in the style of a certain kind of ballad that comes to us from usually Ireland. That talks about another world, the fairy world. The songs describe this place as beautiful but dangerous, since anyone who goes there will find themselves unable to return. This song is like that, except it was written by me in college. I recorded that song, you can get it online I think, but I didn't play it out much, or at all. It was never the right place, or the right time. Three. Dreamtime. When I first visited Ireland, I was 12 years old, and my father had decided it was time to take us, me, my mother, and my sister, there for some time with the ancestors on his side. We touched down in Shannon Airport. I looked out the window at the green hills and heard myself think with unshakable certainty, oh, I'm home. It wasn't true. I was born in New York, raised in New Jersey, and I'm an American citizen. And yet, from that moment, Ireland's non-literal landscape was never far from me. My dreams, my music, or my general aesthetic, though I didn't see the country again until I was in college. To the bewilderment of friends and family, I chose to do my semester abroad in Ireland's Texas, not my joke, County Cork. Hot tip, if you're planning to spend an entire semester of your education over there, go for Dublin. Perhaps traumatized by the dissonance of real-world University College Cork versus the fantasy mothership Ireland of my childhood, I didn't visit again for 10 years. In 2005, I found myself in Dublin for a long weekend with a boyfriend who was not my boyfriend for much longer after that trip. It had been a long time coming, but it was, of course, Ireland that finally broke us up. Watching his response, or lack of such, to the country, I realized he did not and would not ever really understand me. Fair? Who knows? But it's always been that way. In my life, Ireland calls the shots. She is my life, my love, and my lady. Brandy, you're a fine girl. On the last night of that trip, we were at a pub with my Dublin theater friend, Sharon, and a few others. Sharon was urging me to come along for a longer visit and to stay. You know, you should really come along in the fall when the theater festivals are happening. You've that one-woman show you wrote. You can maybe do it over here, at least meet some heads, you know? theater heads who can talk to you about it. It's really best if you're here, not emailing, you know? I answered Sharon with a kind of sad shrug, saying, yeah, I'd love to, but, you know, I have this day job and I really can't get the time off. Then the mothership comes sailing on the white sea foam. A few months later, an email from her, addressed to me and another woman. Mary, meet Rebecca. Rebecca, meet Mary. Mary is looking for someone to swap apartments with, New York to Dublin, in September or October, during the time of the theater festivals. Emphasis hers. When the mothership may call you, you will surely go. Before you could say ancestral homeland, I had divested myself of both day job and boyfriend, booked a scarily low number of gigs, I think 3, which turned into 14 just before I got there because the Irish are more, shall we say, spontaneous in their business dealings, and a plane ticket. Sharon had also set up a meeting with a literary manager from the famed Druid Theater, who agreed to host a reading of my solo show. And with that good news, I was away. Kyrie. Sanctified. My house, I email giddily to my sister over my cup of berries tea, has a blue door and a black gate. I love it. A month ago, a long black cast iron key arrived in a padded envelope in my New York mailbox. And now I'm here. Mary's place is in a suburb of Dublin called Drimna. It has a backyard where a magpie and a gray cat hang out, and miracle of New York miracles, 2 floors, an upstairs and a downstairs. It's also a block from the Luas, the brand spanking new above-ground transit system that speaks the names of each stop in both English and Irish, using soothing automated tones. Drimna, if you're wondering, sounds pretty much the same in both. Drimna. Drimna. I'm getting pretty good at my pronunciation. Golden Bridge. Andrahidorka. I've managed to settle into touring in Ireland as if I'd been doing it all my life instead of 2 weeks. Get on a cross-country train. You can get cross-country in 3 hours, so I've already done it several times. Lunch from train snack cart that comes around. Get to the venue or the pub. Soundcheck. Pint. Play. Listen. Make new friends. In Wexford, the booker insisted on a CD in lieu of payment for my night in the hotel, of which he was also the owner. In Dundalk, the radio DJ insisted I come back home with him to meet the wife and have a spot of lunch. I never want to leave. She met the host one night on a moonlit cobblestone street and was never heard from again. Do not hide your heart. Do not break your hold. Yesterday, I was standing on the train platform in Galway and thinking, how did I afford this train ticket? Seriously? I remember thinking this, and I also remember realizing, oh yeah, I've been paid. Talk about culture shock. When the mothership may call, it's dusk. I put my teacup in the sink, slide on my leather jacket, rumple my boy pet hair, and pick up my guitar. I have a gig in town tonight at the Project Arts Center in Dublin's Temple Bar. 5. Hallelujah. Sometimes a gig is just a gig. This is not one of those times. Tonight, I already know things will be different. The Project Art Center, for one, is not a pub or a music venue, but a theater. And not just a theater, but a very hip, experimental, contemporary theater. And not just a very hip, experimental, contemporary theater either, but, since again, Ireland is very small, the very hip, experimental, modern, contemporary theater that there is in the country. It's like, pretend New York Theater Workshop and St. Anne's Warehouse and, I don't know, BAM, were all just rolled into one cube-shaped, black, boxy-type space and funded by the City Arts Council. Pretend there's an arts council for that. And pretend that because of a general confidence in their audience, the theater is able and willing to put up a run of shows that have no set script and no consistent cast. Shows fluid enough in nature to say, cast a complete stranger in the day before without fanfare beyond, why don't you come along tomorrow night and play a few songs in the show? In case you haven't figured it out, that was me. A week ago, I'd gone in for a meeting with the artistic director of the Project Arts about my solo show. He was a lovely man who somehow made me completely forget that he was an important theater person and I was a shaggy interloper. He congratulated me for having my show staged in Galway, but was clear that the piece was of no interest to St. Bam's Theatre Workshop of Temple Bar. However, Before sending me into the gray afternoon, he made the above offer, and I, jacked up on goodwill and chocolate biscuits, agreed. I don't now remember much about the actual show that I was in fact in. I don't remember anyone's name. I don't remember anyone's name in general, or what it was called, only that the theme was Dublin itself, the city's history and people and culture, and yet somehow it was going to involve me. I don't really have any songs about Ireland, I'd said. They said that was Brad. I do recall that the program besides me also featured a couple of Irish actors reading selections from James Joyce's Ulysses and a charming elderly Dublin historian who lectured about Dublin fun facts. I know. Can you imagine anything more exciting and commercially viable by usual standards? The audience, the full house of who are these people, applaud enthusiastically. They applaud my songs. They applaud after the James Joyce readings. They applaud after Dublin historian drones on about something I have completely forgotten for like 20 minutes. I do too. The whole thing is just kind of beautiful and pleasant. It's somewhat disorganized and kind of boring, but it's happening. It's okay. No one is going to show business jail. And everyone is listening. Then something happens. Dublin historian is gently telling everyone to get up on their feet for the last portion of the evening. They do. The doors behind me in the back wall of the theater, there's a door there? Are being opened. The street lamp and the breeze from the River Liffey floods in. We can hear the lads in Temple Bar shouting. Acoustic guitar covers. The occasional horn honking. Dublin of an evening. The cobblestones are wet. It's raining softly, but that's not unusual, and no one seems to care much. We all exit the theater and follow the white-headed historian out into the night. He doesn't say where we're going, and no one asks. No one tells me I have to go, too. And I don't ask, I just follow. No one tells me to take my guitar with me. I've played my two songs already. But I just do. When the nighttime comes and the salt wind blows, umbrellas go up, and we are all in sort of a merry hush, walking close together with purpose, still in the show. Our guide Blake leads us around a corner and down into an alley. It's dark now, fully night. Now it's the brilliant moon lighting everything, from the water drops on the grass, to the sudden freestanding incongruous black iron gate someone is opening and that we all silently now, in the autumn night, pass through. The way I remember it is this. We are all huddled in a little garden plot of grass between two buildings, hidden from the world. In my memory, all the sounds of the city fall away. It's still raining, a soft rain, gentle on your skin, though the umbrellas stay up. I remember, in a general way, the kindly blur of the faces around me, and I remember the benevolent face of our guide, showing us this hidden and special place. I knew it was special before he said anything. I felt a hum in the air, a swimming behind my eyes, something stir and lock beneath my feet, rooting me to the spot. I stood very still, listening for something. And he said, "This, ladies and gentlemen, is the very place where Handel's Messiah, with its wonderful Hallelujah chorus, was performed for the very first time. The first time in the world, right here." There's an appreciative murmuring, and I wait, kind of knowing what's coming next before he even says it. And ladies and gentlemen, as far as we know, there hasn't been any music performed on this spot at all, until now. And he points at me. And everyone turns to look. And I realize I didn't bring my guitar with me to this moment. It brought me. And I also suddenly remember a song for this time and this place, a place I have never actually left. And standing under the black umbrellas among the smiling faces of the host, I play it. I sing the place alive as it will be again and as it has been. Kyrie, sanctify, 100 times before me.
Now, switching it up, A young person leaps to conclusions in what should be a carefree setting, but all is not as it seems. Molly Tauger has just returned to New York from a year living and working in Mexico, which you can read about in her blog at muchasdonas.wordpress.com. But before you do, give a listen as Rebecca Hart performs See You in the Morning, I Love You Goodnight by Molly Tauger.
See you in the morning, I love you goodnight. That's how we say it in my family. One word, like supercalifragilistic, or forget about it. I have no idea how it started, but when I was a kid, I insisted on it. Once tucked in, I would say it, see you in the morning, I love you, good night, and then my mom or dad had to say it back, see you in the morning, I love you, good night. My parents thought it more sweet than OCD, and in fact, we still say it when I go home to visit. I don't insist on it anymore, which is good because I'm 37. But truth be told, I prefer to say it than not. As a kid, I was into rituals. In addition to see you in the morning, I love you, good night, every evening I would set up a pair of shoes by my bed, heels together, toes out, because I had learned from reading Rainbow that this would keep evil spirits away. When I woke up, I would go straight to the piano to play the right-hand part of Mouret's Rondo, the opening theme of Masterpiece Theater. A perfect run was a good omen. As you can see, PBS had a strong influence on me. It was all that my parents watched, and one of the few channels that came in on our crappy black and white television. My rituals, like most rituals, were an attempt to control forces beyond me, an appeal for well-being. Once I got to school, everything was out of my hands. I was skinny, shy, prone to getting lost in my own thoughts, and constantly setting off social tripwires. If I wasn't saying the wrong thing, I was bringing the wrong lunch or wearing the wrong ski jacket. Since I couldn't predict when I'd screw up, I tried to blend into the wall. Invisibility equaled peace. As a young kid, I blamed myself for my inability to fit in. Clearly, I was just inherently flawed. But over time, it dawned on me that it was actually my parents' fault. Who put a lamb chop wrapped in wax paper in my lunch bag? Who bought the off-brand ski jacket at the bargain center? Who left New York to plop our Jewish olive-skinned family in a town full of white, pasty Irish Catholics simply so my dad could be a professor? Towards the end of elementary school, I sometimes fantasized that my parents would die, forcing me to live with their friends in California who had an in-ground pool and three kids who each had their own TVs. They would buy me Nintendo and a full wardrobe of Esprit clothing. I could start over in a place where my reputation was not indelibly set as the weird girl. By the time I was 13, I was fully irascible, but significantly less isolated. I had developed a close group of girlfriends, and while not cool nor terribly popular, I was no longer a constant target. I spent the summer of 1988 working as a junior camp counselor at a day camp, leading six-year-olds in choruses of Boom Chicka Boom, and nights and weekends out with my girlfriends. Since we were good girls, out generally meant the movies, the mall, or someone's house making Rice Krispie treats. But that was okay. If I was home, I was lame. If I was out, I was all right. It was in the middle of that summer that my dad went to a physics conference in Pittsburgh. We often tacked our family vacations onto his conferences, frequently to places I didn't want to go, like Bozeman, Montana. But because it was Pittsburgh, this year the family vacation part had gotten nixed. The night before he left, my dad knocked on my bedroom door and stuck his head in. See you in the morning, I love you, good night, he said cheerily. Dad, you need to wait for me to say come in. He closed the door and this time knocked. This irritated me more. Just come in, I said. He opened the door. I'm leaving early, so I'm saying goodbye now, he said. Say goodbye in the morning. You really want me to wake you up? The dubiousness was fair. The next day was Sunday, and most weekends I slept till noon. No, I said, still staring at my book. I'll get up on my own. As he closed the door, it was on the tip of my tongue. See you in the morning, I love you, good night. But because I was annoyed, I didn't say it. When I woke up at noon, he was gone. I felt a pang of guilt, but I forgot it when Marie called to ask if I wanted to watch Top Gun in her basement with our other friends. Marie O'Neill was my best friend. Her basement was our regular summer hangout because it had air conditioning, an orange shag rug for lounging, and an excellent selection of snacks. It was early evening, and we were sprawled and stuffing ourselves with Cool Ranch Doritos when Mrs. O'Neill yelled down to say that my mom was on the phone. Annoyed at being forced to move, I hauled myself off the carpet and trudged upstairs. I picked up the receiver. Yep. Your sister won't go to bed until she tells you something, my mom said. My sister was 7 and stubborn, so this didn't surprise me. Fine, I said, put her on. My sister got on, and I immediately could tell she'd been crying. What's wrong? I said, not entirely sympathetically. At the time, she fell into the category of wrongs done me by my family. She was more popular and sportier than I had been at her age, and her cheery existence dented my theory that our parents ruined lives. She sobbed and didn't answer. What's wrong? I said again. She said something I couldn't understand.
Daddy,
she sniffed. What? I said.
Daddy,
and suddenly, I got it. Daddy died. What? I whispered. There was shuffling as she handed the phone back to my mother. I braced myself against the hall table. Is it true? I asked. I'm afraid so, my mother said. She sounded almost nonchalant. Can you come get me? Aren't the O'Neills driving you home? Can you come get me? I said again, and perhaps hearing my distress, my mother agreed. Well, all right, I'll be there in 20 minutes. I hung up the phone and I stood for a moment. Then I opened the basement door, walked down a few steps, and then sat down on the stairs. Below me, my friends were lazing where I'd left them. On TV, Maverick and Goose were getting reamed out by their commanding officer for flying below 10,000 feet. It was quiet, except for the TV and the crunching of Doritos. I tried to think of what I was supposed to do. My thoughts were like vapor. They formed and disappeared. I sat with my hands in my lap. Eventually, someone looked up. Are you okay? My dad died, I said. Suddenly, they were running up the stairs, hugging me, asking what happened. I didn't know. Marie ran to tell her parents. I felt numb. Then there was the sound of a stampede. Marie's parents had been told. Arms hauled me into the dining room and placed me in a chair. Marie's mom kept her hands on my shoulders. Honey, what happened? She asked. I said again that I didn't know. It hadn't occurred to me to find out. Maybe the plane went down. Maybe it was a heart attack. I could see my friends crying, but I couldn't hear them. It was as if someone had turned the volume down, and there was only the one thought repeating, Daddy died. I hadn't said goodbye. Can I get you some water? Marie's mom asked. I shook my head. Everyone stared at me. I stared at a spot in the middle of the table and tried to make myself feel something. Daddy died. My dad, who went bird watching in the neighborhood with binoculars, making me terrified that people would think he was a Peeping Tom. My dad, who drew my birth announcement showing my parents as cartoon chickens welcoming an egg. My dad, who filled every shelf in our house with antique books from garage sales, who planned all our vacations, who smelled like Old Spice when he kissed me goodnight after he and my mom went on dates. Would we still go on vacation? Would we move? Would my mom marry someone else? After a few minutes, Marie's mom asked if I wanted to lie down on the couch. I shook my head again, and then suddenly, like vomit coming up, adrenaline flooded my body. I got up and ran to the front door and outside. Everyone chased after me. I got to the middle of the yard, and Marie's dad grabbed me and hugged me tight. I sobbed, and my knees buckled. I could barely breathe. It was then that my mother's white Honda Civic materialized at the corner. She pulled into the driveway, her window down. She looked surprisingly cheerful for a new widow. Marie's mom walked up to the car. Hallie, I'm so sorry. She said, what was it? A hamster, my mom said. And there it was. A hamster killed my father. For a moment, I imagined it must have been like the story where the mouse kills the elephant by climbing up his trunk. A hamster on the plane. He climbed up my dad's nose out of his plastic cup and suffocated him. Excuse me? Mrs. O'Neill said. Naomi's hamster died, my mom said, looking increasingly confused, having now taken in the weeping group of eighth grade girls and her prostrate daughter. Teddy died, I said, still clinging to Mr. O'Neill. Oh my God, we thought Jerry died! Suddenly comprehending the mistake in identity. Then she began to laugh. And then everyone else laughed. I didn't. The adrenaline was shifting from grief to humiliation and fury. I thought you said Daddy died! He's in Pittsburgh, my mom said. He called earlier. He's fine. How could you let me think he was dead? I yelled. How could I know what you thought? My mother said reasonably, which infuriated me more. Fully relieved now, my friends were wrapped with fits of giggles. Mr. O'Neill doubled over, wiping his twinkly Irish eyes. Teddy died, he cried. My cheeks burned. Do you still want to come home? My mom said. Yes, I said. I didn't understand how this could suddenly be hilarious. I thought my father was dead. That wasn't funny. I wanted to be alone. I got in the car and we drove home. I asked if I could skip camp the next day. My mom said no. Don't remember my dad coming home, save that by the time he'd arrived, I'd gotten over his being dead. I quickly resumed presenting both of my parents. But see you in the morning, I love you, good night. I never didn't say it again. Just in case.
That's it. Thanks for joining us for this installment of Know You Tell It.
Visit us on the web at knowyoutellit.com.